While wrapping a towel around my body, and I see the pattern of bruising inching from my waist down to my mid-thigh, I see how physical spaces punish me for my unruly body. The pain can be unbearable. Sometimes I think the pain will break me. Anytime I enter a room where I might be expected to sit, I am overcome by anxiety. What kind of chairs will I find? Will they have arms? Will they be sturdy? How long will I have to sit in them? If I do manage to wedge myself between a chair's narrow arms, will I be able to pull myself out? If the chair is too low, will I be able to stand up on my own? This recitation of questions is constant, as are the recriminations I offer myself for putting myself in the position of having to deal with such anxieties by virtue of my fat body. This is an unspoken humiliation a lot of the time. People have eyes. They can plainly see that a given chair might be too small, but they say nothing as they watch me try to squeeze myself into a seat that has no interest in accommodating me. They say nothing when making plans to include me in these inhospitable places. I cannot tell if this is casual cruelty or willful ignorance. As an undergraduate, I dreaded classrooms where I would have to wedge myself into one of those seats with a desk attached. I dreaded the humiliation of sitting or half-sitting in such a chair, my fat spilling everywhere, one or both of my legs going numb, hardly able to breathe as the desk dug into my stomach. At movie theaters, I pray the auditorium has been outfitted with movable armrests or I am in for some hurt. I love plays and musicals, but I rarely attend the theater because I simply cannot fit. When I do attend such events, I suffer and can barely concentrate because I'm in so much pain. I beg off socializing a lot, and friends think I am more antisocial than I really am because I don't want to have to explain why I cannot join them. Before I go to a restaurant, I obsessively check the restaurant's website and Google Images and Yelp to see what kind of seating it has. Are the seats ultra-modern and flimsy? Do they have arms, and if so, what kind? Are there booths, and if so, does the table move, or is it one of those tables welded between two benches? How long do I think I can sit in those chairs without screaming? I do this obsessive research because people tend to assume that everyone moves through the world the way they do. They never think of how I take up space differently than they do. Picture it. A dinner, two couples, a trendy restaurant. As we are seated, I quickly realize I haven't done my homework. The chairs are sturdy but narrow with rigid arms. I ask the hostess if we can sit at a booth. But even though the restaurant is empty, she says they are already all reserved. I want to cry, but I can't. I'm on a date. We are with friends. My companion knows what I'm feeling, but also knows I wouldn't want any extra attention, knows I will endure the chair rather than make a scene. I am between a rock and a hard place. We are seated, and I perch myself on the edge of the seat. I have done this before. I will do it again. My thighs are very strong. I want to enjoy the meal, the lovely conversation with these treasured friends. I want to enjoy the cocktails and the gorgeous food being put before us, but all I can think about is the pain in my thighs and the arms of the chair pinching my sides and how much longer I will have to pretend everything is fine. When the meal is finally over, relief washes over me. When I stand, I am dizzy and nauseated and aching. Even the happiest moments of my life are overshadowed by my body and how it doesn't fit anywhere. This is no way to live, but this is how I live. 60. I am always uncomfortable or in pain. I don't remember what it's like to feel good in my body, to feel anything resembling comfort. When walking through a door, I eye the dimensions and unconsciously turn sideways, whether I need to or not. When I am walking, there is the twinge of my ankle, a pain in my right heel, a strain in my lower back. I'm often out of breath. I stop sometimes and pretend to look at the scenery or a poster on the wall or, most often, my phone. I avoid walking with other people as often as possible because walking and talking at the same time is a challenge. I avoid walking with other people anyway because I move slowly and they don't. In public bathrooms, I maneuver into stalls. I try to hover over the toilet because I don't want it to break beneath me. No matter how small a bathroom stall is, I avoid the handicap stall because people like to give me dirty looks when I use that stall merely because I am fat and need more space. I am miserable. I try sometimes to pretend I am not, but that, like most everything else in my life, is exhausting. I do my best to pretend I am not in pain, that my back doesn't ache, that I'm not whatever it is I am feeling, because I am not allowed to have a human body. If I am fat, I must also have the body of someone who is not fat. I must defy space and time and gravity. 61. And then there is how strangers treat my body. I am shoved in public spaces, as if my fat inures me from pain, and or as if I deserve pain, punishment for being fat. People step on my feet. They brush and bump against me. They run straight into me. I am highly visible, but I am regularly treated like I am invisible. My body receives no respect or consideration or care in public spaces. My body is treated like a public space. 62. Air travel is another kind of hell. The standard economy class seat is 17.2 inches, while a first class seat is, on average, between 21 and 22 inches wide. The last time I flew in a single coach seat, I was in an exit row for the legroom. I fit in the seat because on that particular airline, Midwest Express, there was no window seat armrest in the exit rows. I boarded and sat. Eventually, my seatmate joined me, and I could instantly tell he was agitated. He kept staring at me and muttering. I could tell he was going to start trouble. I could tell he was going to humiliate me. I was mortified. He leaned into me and asked, "Are you sure you can handle the seat's responsibilities?" He was elderly, rather frail. I was fat, but I was, and I still am, tall and strong. It was absurd to imagine I could not handle the exit row responsibilities. I simply said yes, but I wished I were a braver woman, the kind who would turn his question back on him. When you are fat and traveling, the staring starts from the moment you enter the airport. At the gate, there are so many uncomfortable looks as people make it plain that they do not want to be sitting next to you, having any part of your obese body touching theirs. During the boarding process, when they realize that they have lucked out in this particular game of Russian roulette and will not be seated next to you, their relief is visible, palpable, shameless. On this particular flight, the plane was about to pull away from the gate when this agitated man called for a flight attendant. He stood and followed her to the galley, from where his voice echoed through the plane as he said it was too risky for me to be seated in the exit row. He clearly thought my presence in the exit row meant the end of his life. It was like he knew something about the flight no one else did. I sat there and dug my fingernails into the palms of my hands as people began to turn and stare at me and mutter their own comments. I tried not to cry. Eventually, the agitated man was reseated elsewhere, and once the plane took off, I curled into the side of the plane and cried as invisibly, as silently as I could. From then on, I began to buy two coach seats, which, when I was still relatively young and broke, meant I could rarely travel. The bigger you are, the smaller your world becomes. The bigger you are, the smaller your world becomes. Even when you've bought two coach seats, travel is rife with humiliations. Airlines prefer that obese people buy two tickets, but few airline employees have any sense of how to deal with two boarding passes and the empty seat once the plane is fully boarded. It becomes a big production, first when you are boarding and they need to scan two boarding passes as if this is an unsolvable mystery, and then, once you're seated, as they try to make sense of the discrepancy, no matter how many times you tell them, "Yes, both of these seats are mine." The person on the other side of the empty seat often tries to commandeer some of that space for themselves, though if any part of your body were touching them, they would raise hell. It's an unnerving hypocrisy. I get very salty about that, and the older I get, the more I tell people that they don't get to have it both ways, complaining if any part of my body dared to touch theirs if I bought one seat, but placing their belongings in the empty space of the empty seat I bought for my comfort and sanity. And of course, there is the issue of the seatbelt. I have long traveled with my own seatbelt extender because it can be quite the ordeal to get one from a flight attendant. There are few discreet opportunities to request one. Flight attendants often forget if you ask when, say, boarding the plane. They tend to make a big show of handing it to you when they finally remember, as if punishing you, reminding everyone else on the plane that you are too fat to use the standard seatbelt. Or, this is what it feels like because I am so self-conscious about everything related to my body. By carrying my own seatbelt extender, I have often been able to circumvent these petty humiliations and nuisances, but really, there is no escape. On recent regional flights, I have been told that it is airline regulation to use authorized extenders only. There was one particularly grim flight to Grand Forks, North Dakota, where the flight attendant made me remove my seatbelt extender and take one from her in front of the entire plane before she would allow us to take off. Federal regulations, she said. I am very lucky that I have finally gotten to a place in my career where it is part of my contract with an organization flying me to speak that they have to buy me a first-class ticket. This is my body, and they know it, and if they want me to travel to them, they need to ensure at least some of my dignity. This recitation feels so indulgent, but this is my reality. This, too, is the truth of living in a fat body. It's a lot of weight to bear. Part 5. 63. In Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Julia Child writes, "Cooking is not a particularly difficult art, and the more you cook and learn about cooking, the more sense it makes. But like any art, it requires practice and experience. The most important ingredient you can bring to it is a love of cooking for its own sake." I did not think it was possible for me to love cooking. I did not think such a love was allowed. I did not think I could love food or indulge in the sensual pleasures of eating. It did not occur to me that to cook for myself was to care for myself, or that I was allowed to care for myself amidst the ruin I had let myself become. These things were forbidden to me, the price I paid for being so wildly undisciplined about my body. Food was fuel, nothing more, nothing less, even if I overindulged in that fuel whenever I could. But then I moved to Michigan's Upper Peninsula and lived in a town of about 4,000 while attending graduate school. And after that I took my job in Charleston, Illinois, another small town. I became a vegetarian and realized that if I wanted to eat, I was going to have to prepare meals for myself, or I would be relegated to a diet of iceberg lettuce and french fries. Around that same time, I started watching Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten's cooking show on the Food Network, every day from 4 to 5 p.m., just after I got home from campus. It was a time to let the world go and relax. I love the show. I love everything about Ina. Her hair is always glossy and smooth in a perfectly coiffed dark bob. She wears a variation on the same shirt every day. I learned from the FAQs on her website that her shirt is custom-made, but she won't divulge by whom. She is married to a man named Jeffrey who has a fondness for roast chicken, and if the show is any indication, their relationship is an adoring one. She is intelligent and wealthy and wears these traits comfortably but inoffensively. Ina loves rhetorical questions. How good is that, she'll ask while sampling one of her delicious dishes, or who wouldn't want that for their birthday while planning a surprise for one of her coterie of elegant Hamptons friends, or we need a nice cocktail for breakfast, don't we, when preparing brunch for some of her many, always attractive, wealthy, and often gay friends. There is one episode where she takes food, bagels and lox, on a trip to Brooklyn to eat more food at a farmer's market or some such. I love Ina Garten so much, one of my wireless networks at home is named Barefoot Contessa. It's like she's watching over me that way. Ina Garten makes cooking seem easy, accessible. She loves good ingredients, good vanilla, good olive oil, good everything. She is always offering helpful tips. Very cold butter makes pastry dough better, and a cook's best tools are clean hands. She uses an ice cream scoop for the dough when she's making muffins, and reminds the audience of this trick with a conspiratorial grin. When she shops in town, she always asks the butcher or fishmonger or baker to put her purchases on her account. She doesn't sully herself with cash. One day, she invites some construction workers who are rehabbing a windmill over for lunch, and she decorates the table with construction accessories like a tarp and some paintbrushes and a bucket. As she prepares their meal, she makes sure to provide man-sized portions, to be followed by a brownie pie, a decadent affair I would eventually try to bake. What I love most about Ina is that she teaches me about fostering a strong sense of self and self-confidence. She teaches me about being at ease in my body. From all appearances, she is entirely at ease with herself. She is ambitious and knows she is excellent at what she does and never apologizes for it. She teaches me that a woman can be plump and pleasant and absolutely in love with food. She gives me permission to love food. She gives me permission to acknowledge my hungers and to try and satisfy them in healthy ways. She gives me permission to buy the good ingredients she is so fond of recommending so that I might make good food for myself and the people for whom I enjoy cooking. She gives me permission to embrace my ambition and believe in myself. In the case of Barefoot Contessa, a cooking show is far more than just a cooking show. 64. I am not the kind of person who can survey the pantry, identify 4 or 5 random ingredients, and assemble a delicious meal. I need the protection and comfort of recipes. I require gentle instruction and guidance. On a good day, I can experiment with a recipe, try to mix things up, but I need a foundation of some kind. There is, I must admit, something very satisfying about making things from scratch, to know every dish in a meal was made by your own hands. As a lazy person, I'm a fan of pre-made things, but it was a lot of fun and deeply relaxing to make, for example, my own dough and my own cherry filling for a beautiful cherry pie. I felt productive and capable. What has fascinated me about cooking, and coming to it in the middle of my life, is how it's actually a really good endeavor for a control freak. There are rules, and to succeed, at least in the early going, those rules need to be followed. I am good at following rules when I choose to. I take particular pleasure in baking, which is a challenge because baked goods are generally not conducive to healthy eating or weight loss. But I teach, and so sometimes I bake and bring treats to work to share with my students or colleagues. Part of the pleasure of baking is in its precision. Unlike cooking, which favors experimentation, baking requires weighing and measuring and exact times and temperatures. The pleasure of having rules to follow is multiplied. Things often go wrong and cooking can be messy, but the act of creating something from disparate ingredients still remains satisfying. Cooking reminds me that I am capable of taking care of myself and worthy of taking care of and nourishing myself. 65. Food itself is complicated for me. I enjoy it too much. I like cooking, but I hate grocery shopping. I'm busy. I am an embarrassingly picky eater. I am always trying to lose weight. This combination has me always in search of programs or products that will make it possible for me to manage dealing with all of these issues at once. I tried a service called Fresh 20, which does the meal planning but leaves you responsible for the grocery shopping. I've tried Weight Watchers, I've tried eating only lean cuisines, I've tried low-carb diets, I've tried high-protein diets, I've tried combinations of various things, I've tried Slim Fast during the day and one real meal at night, I've tried to keep healthy snacks around, fake junk food that only depresses me as it tries to serve as a plausible substitute for the real thing, beet chips, kale chips, pea crisps, rice cakes. Then I've thrown all that fake junk food out because I don't want fake junk food. I want real junk food. And if I cannot have real junk food, I'd rather have no junk food at all. I've tried to eat fruits and nuts. I've tried fasting every other day. I've tried eating all my meals before 8 p.m. I've tried eating 5 small meals a day. I've tried drinking enormous quantities of water each day to fill my stomach. I've tried to ignore my hunger. In truth, these attempts have always been either fairly half-assed or short-lived. In my quest to better nourish myself, I joined Blue Apron when I moved to Indiana in 2014. Blue Apron is a subscription service where each week they send you the ingredients and the correct portions for 3 meals. They deal with 2 of the most unpleasant cooking-related tasks, meal planning and grocery shopping. I was kind of skeptical about meal kits because members are given little control over the meals they receive. But if I was going to try and take better care of myself, I was going to put my best foot forward. It's really cute how everything is labeled and packaged. There are knickknacks that include things like tiny bottles of champagne vinegar and a little ramekin of mayonnaise. As someone who loves tiny things, I always considered unpacking the box something of an event. The ingredients are accompanied by full-color, full-page recipe cards with step-by-step instructions and pictures. There is little room for error, and yet there is still the human factor. I am the one who is left to prepare the meals, and my fallibility is particularly pronounced in the kitchen. My first meal was a cannellini bean and escarole salad with crispy potatoes. I wasn't at all sure what escarole is, but I decided it was spicy lettuce, a better, more accurate name. The amount of spicy lettuce Blue Apron sent was laughable, so I added a head of romaine hearts because lettuce has no calories or nutritional value, but it can take up some space on a plate. The recipe was simple enough. I washed and peeled two potatoes, sliced them, boiled them for the prescribed amount of time. While that was happening, I made the dressing, mayonnaise, fresh-squeezed lemon, garlic. The recipe also called for capers, but I hate them, so slimy and ugly. And while I was trying to work through my pickiness, there was only so much progress to be made in one sitting. When the potatoes were ready, they went onto a baking sheet, and I drizzled them with olive oil, salt, and pepper. They baked at 500 degrees for 25 minutes, and my kitchen got unbearably hot. I began thinking about the melancholy of cooking for yourself when you are single and living alone. One of the many reasons it took me so long to learn how to cook and learn to enjoy cooking is that it often feels like such a waste to go to all that trouble for myself. Dinner would not wait for melancholy, so after rinsing and draining the beans, I softened a yellow onion, then assembled the salad, adding tomato, the beans, the lettuce, the dressing, all served over the crispy potatoes. It all turned out fine, even though I had the saddest collection of kitchen tools aiding me in the process. It was the first time in my life something I prepared bore any resemblance to the recipe from whence it came. In another box, there were ingredients for an English pea ravioli dish. I began by softening four cloves of garlic and some onion. The onion looked hideous because I do not have knife skills. What should have been orderly diced onion was a quantity of awkwardly shaped onion chunks. When the onion and garlic were softened, I added the English peas, some salt and pepper. It all smelled good. I felt accomplished and maybe even a little powerful, the mistress of my culinary domain. I took the onions and peas off the heat and added some chopped mint and then added it to fresh ricotta, an egg, and some Parmesan cheese. This was, in theory, the filling for my ravioli. It's interesting. I've noticed while cooking how ingredients in their individual and naked state can be a bit repulsive but necessary, kind of like people. The egg, Parmesan, and ricotta, so wet and loose, did not thrill me. It felt way too intimate. And then it came time to assemble the ravioli. I thought I followed the instructions correctly, but the ravioli did not reflect that. The assembly process itself was irritating. The pasta sheets wouldn't hold together no matter what I tried. I crimped the edges with a fork, but the edges would not stay crimped. I nearly threw the disastrous-looking ravioli against a wall, because the tenor of my aggravation was wildly disproportionate to the potential of the meal I was attempting. In the end, I decided, fuck it, and threw the sloppy mess into boiling water, hoping for the best, prepared to eat the worst. The pockets of pasta I had tried to create quickly dissembled, coming apart limply at the seams. Tragedy was multiplying. Once I thought the pasta was sufficiently cooked, I drained the whole mess into a strainer, and then put that mess into a saucepan with brown butter and let it simmer until it looked at least somewhat edible. The dissembled ravioli ended up tasting fine, and I am sure there was a lesson in there somewhere about how almost anything can be salvaged when you cook, but I never did find that lesson. Blue Apron and other meal kit services are well and good, but sometimes cooking is such a pain in the ass. It is exhausting wrapping my mind around having to prepare food to put in my body every single day, and living alone, I am always the one responsible for that preparation. The more I cook for myself, the richer my appreciation for women and men who cook for their families every day grows. Some nights, it is a question of whether I have peanut butter, jelly, and bread so that the dinner problem is thusly solved. Of course, I cannot help but wonder when basic meals became problems rather than meals, complicated ordeals rather than daily, sustaining rituals. I love food, but it is so difficult to enjoy food. It is so difficult to believe I am allowed to enjoy food. Mostly, food is a constant reminder of my body, my lack of willpower, my biggest flaws. 66. When I ask my mother for her recipes, she is at once helpful and vague. She shares the basic ingredients and cooking instructions, but I can never quite replicate the taste of her dishes. Once, I asked her for a recipe for soup jumu, which Haitians prepare for New Year's Day, our Independence Day. This is what my mother offered. 2 heads of cabbage, peas, butternut squash, leeks, potatoes, turnips, carrots, onions, cilantro and parsley, beef tenderloin. Cook meat until tender over low heat. Season to taste with garlic, salt, black pepper, and hot peppers. Add water. Add vegetables. I have never attempted this recipe. My mother always insists she is giving me or my sisters-in-law the complete recipe, but I cannot shake the sense she is holding back, keeping a secret or two to herself, so what is unique about her cooking, her affection for her family, will always be in her sole possession. Sauce is the staple of many Haitian meals, tomato-based, fragrant, delicious. Even when my mother makes American food, sauce is on the table. It goes with everything. If my dad sits at the dinner table and doesn't see the sauce, he asks, "Where is the sauce?" And my mother scowls. Sometimes she is simply teasing him and the sauce is in the oven warmer. Sometimes she isn't in the mood to make it. I never seem to hold on to the most important elements of my mother's recipes. So when I am in my own home trying to cook certain Haitian dishes, I call home and she patiently walks me through the recipe. The sauce, a simple but elusive dish, stymies me. My mother reminds me to put on my cooking gloves. I pretend that such a thing would ever find a place in my kitchen. She tells me to slice onions and red peppers, setting the vegetables aside after a stern reminder to wash everything. My kitchen fills with the warmth of home. The sauce always turns out well enough, but not great. I cannot place what precisely is off, and my suspicion that my mother has withheld some vital piece of information grows. As I eat the foods of my childhood, prepared by my own hand, I am filled with longing and a quiet anger that has risen from my family's hard love and good intentions. There is one Haitian dish I have mastered, our macaroni and cheese, which is filling but not as heavy as the American version. When I attend a potluck, an activity I dread because I am extraordinarily picky and suspicious of communal foods, I bring this dish. People are always impressed. They feel more cosmopolitan, I think. They expect there to be a rich narrative behind the dish because we have cultural expectations about ethnic food. I don't know how to explain that for me the dish is simply food that I love, but one I cannot connect to in the way they assume. Instead of being a statement on my family's culture, this dish and most other Haitian foods are tied up in my love for my family and a quiet, unshakable anger. And still, when I am with my family, when we become that island unto ourselves, I allow myself to be a part of them. I am trying to forgive and make up for lost time, to close the distances I put between us even though it was necessary, for a time, for me to be apart from them. These are the people who know not all of me, but know enough, know what matters most. They continue to love me so hard, and I love them hard in return. Every New Year's Eve, we all convene in Florida and attend a gala at my parents' country club. There is a 5-course meal, lots of tiny twee dishes, there is drinking and dancing. Even surrounded by 100 other people, we are unto ourselves. We return to my parents' house by 1 in the morning and the party continues, furniture moved, compas music playing, more dancing, my brothers and cousin and me staring at the breathtaking spectacle of this family. The beautiful beast we become when we are together. My hunger is particularly acute when I visit my parents. For one, they are minimalists when it comes to keeping food in the house. They travel a lot, so it doesn't make sense to keep fresh produce around, knowing it will likely spoil before it is eaten. And though they eat, and I am sure, enjoy a good meal, my parents are not people who take exceptional pleasure in food. They rarely snack. Any food in the house generally requires some kind of preparation. But there is also the paranoia I develop. I feel like everything I do is being watched, scrutinized, judged. I deprive myself to give the appearance of conforming, of making some small effort to become thinner, better, less of a family problem, because that's what they tell me. My weight is a family problem. So in addition to my body, I carry that burden too, knowing that my loved ones consider me their problem until I finally lose the weight. I start to crave foods, any foods. I get uncomfortable urges to binge, to satisfy the growing ache, to fill the hollowness of feeling alone around the people who are supposed to love me the most, to soothe the pain of having the same painful conversations year after year after year after year. I am so much more than hungry when I am home. I am starving. I am an animal. I am desperate to be fed. 67. I come from a beautiful family. They are thin, stylish, attractive. Often, when I am around them, I do not feel like I belong. I do not feel like I deserve to be among them. When I look at family photos, which I assiduously avoid, I think one of these things is not like the other, and it is a haunting, lonely feeling, thinking you don't belong with the very people who know you in the truest, deepest ways. My father is tall, lean, and lanky, with a distinguished air about him. My mother is petite, beautiful, and elegant. When I was a child, her hair cascaded down her back and was so long she could sit on it. She loves to wear heels. My brothers are tall and athletic, handsome. One of them knows it and will happily tell you about all his charms. And then there is me, ever expanding. I cannot enjoy food around my family, but to be fair, food is not something I can enjoy around most people. To be seen while I am eating feels like being on trial. When we do eat together, my family watches me, or I feel like they are watching me because I am hyper-self-conscious, because they are concerned. Or, more accurately, my family used to intently watch me eating, monitor me, try to control me, and fix me. Now, though they have largely resigned themselves to this state of my body, I will forever feel like they are watching me and looking right through me. They still want to help even as they hurt me. I accept this, or I try. And then, when I am introduced to new people who know my family, there is always this look on their faces of what I will charitably call shock. "You're Roxanne? You're the one I've heard so many wonderful things about?" they ask. And then I have to break their hearts by saying, "Yes, I am indeed part of this beautiful family." I know the look well. I've seen it many, many times at family gatherings and celebrations. It's hard to take. It crushes whatever shreds of confidence I muster. This isn't in my head. This isn't poor self-esteem. This is what comes from years of being the fat one in the beautiful family. For so long, I've never talked about this. I suppose we should keep our shames to ourselves, but I'm sick of this shame. Silence hasn't worked out that well. Or maybe this is someone else's shame, and I'm just being forced to carry it. 68. When I was 19 years old, I came out to my parents over the telephone. I was in the Arizona desert, far from them, living with a couple I barely knew, working the kind of job that would scandalize anyone who knew me. I had cracked up, quite literally. I had dropped out of my Ivy League college and run away, cutting off all contact with everyone whom I knew and loved and who loved me. I was having an emotional breakdown, but I didn't have the necessary vocabulary to explain myself or to understand why I was making such choices. The second-to-last woman I loved during my 20s, Fiona, finally made the grand gesture I always wanted her to make after I moved on, or convinced myself I had moved on, because she would never give me what I needed: commitment, fidelity, affection. We were still friends, but I was seeing someone else, Adriana, who was beautiful and kind and crazy, though we too would ultimately be incompatible. Adriana lived across the country and was visiting me in the Midwest. We were having a good time. We did not yet know the worst things about each other. As these things seemed to go, something about Adriana's temporary presence in our city made Fiona realize I was almost beyond her grasp. My relationship with Fiona had been largely unspoken. We spent all our time together. Sometimes we were intimate. We knew each other's families. She was single and developed infatuations and sometimes relationships with other women, and still, I was there. We were there. It was enough until it wasn't. And there was Adriana. She wanted to give me more, and I let her, even though I didn't have enough to give her. During Adriana's visit, Fiona kept calling me. There was an urgency in her voice I had always wanted to hear. She needed me, and I was in a complicated place where being needed was very attractive. At one point during her visit, I dropped off Adriana at a bookstore and ran to Fiona's house because she said she simply had to see me. I don't even remember what we talked about, but I do remember that when I went to pick up Adriana, I felt guilty, couldn't look her in the eye. I had gotten into the habit, you see, of dating women who wouldn't give me what I wanted, who couldn't possibly love me enough because I was a gaping wound of need. I couldn't admit this to myself, but there was a pattern of intense emotional masochism, of throwing myself into the most dramatic relationships possible, of needing to be a victim of some kind over and over and over. That was something familiar, something I understood. When they finally tracked me down and we spoke, all my parents wanted to know was why I disappeared, because they are good parents who love their children fiercely. They would never let me go, not really. I was too young and too messed up to realize what I was putting them through. For that, I still carry regret. I didn't know what to tell them. I couldn't say, I am completely broken down and losing my mind because something terrible happened to me, though that was the truth. I thought about their faith and their culture. I told them the one thing that I thought might finally sever the bond between us. It's not that I didn't want my parents in my life, but I didn't know how to be broken and be the daughter they thought they knew. I blurted out, I'm gay. This too shames me. Not my queerness, but how little faith I put in them and how warped my understanding of queerness was. Saying I was gay wasn't true, but it wasn't a lie. I was and am attracted to women. I find them rather intriguing. At the time, I didn't know I could be attracted to both women and men and be part of this world. And in those early days, I enjoyed dating women and having sex with them, but also I was terrified of men. The truth is always messy. I wanted to do everything in my power to remove the possibility of being with men from my life. I failed at that, but I told myself I could be gay and I wouldn't be hurt ever again. I needed to never be hurt again. My parents were not thrilled to hear that their only daughter was gay. My mother made a comment about how she knew because I once told her I wanted to get married in denim. I failed to see the connection. I expected my parents to turn their backs on me, but they did nothing of the sort. They asked me to come home and I couldn't go to them, not yet. I couldn't let them know how broken I was. Still, we were talking again. A few months later, I would go home and they would welcome me. For some time, things wouldn't be right between us, but they wouldn't be wrong. And much later, things would be right, and they would see me for who I am and welcome the women I loved into their home and love me for who I am. I would realize that had always been the case. The first woman I slept with was big and beautiful. I still remember how she smelled. Her skin was so soft. She was kind when I was starving for kindness. It was just a one-night stand at a party. Several CDs played during our tryst. It was an experience. My tongue tingles when I think of her name. The next woman I slept with I called my girlfriend, even though we barely knew each other. We met on the internet, and I packed up my stuff and I flew to Minnesota from Arizona to be with her in the dead of winter. I had a suitcase, no winter clothing, and it was so cold the locks on her car froze. I did not know such a thing was possible. She lived in a dark, cramped basement apartment where I couldn't stand all the way up because I was too tall. We were ridiculous and young. We lasted 2 weeks. For the next several years, I dated a string of women who were terrible and new in different ways. There was the woman who grabbed my arm so hard she left a bruise. There was the woman who enjoyed the outdoors, camping and women's music festivals, all of which I found horrifying. There was the woman who cheated on me and left the evidence of her transgression in my car. The bathroom at an Olive Garden was involved, which only added insult to injury. There was the woman who told me she could see being with me in the future, but didn't know how to be with me every day between now and that hypothetical future. I was also terrible and new in different ways. I was equally, if not more, culpable in these relationships. I was far too insecure and needy, constantly needing affirmation that I was loved, that I was good enough to be loved. I was emotionally manipulative in trying to get that affirmation. I had terrible judgment with women because I labored under the delusion that a woman couldn't hurt me, not like a man could. If a woman demonstrated any interest in me, I reciprocated her feelings, a gut reflex. I fell into the dangerous trap of being in love with the idea of being in love. I wanted to be wanted and needed. Time and again, I ended up with women who wouldn't or couldn't give me a fraction of what I desired. I ended up with women to whom I couldn't or wouldn't give a fraction of what they desired. I performed my queerness so I could believe this half-truth I had told everyone, that I had told myself. I marched. I was here and queer. In the way of young queers of my day, I wore an excessive number of pride rings and pins and such. I slathered my car in stickers. I was passionately militant about any number of issues without fully understanding why. To make matters worse, I was still attracted to men, often intensely. In bed with my girlfriends, I sometimes pretended I was with someone else, someone with a body harder in certain places, leaner in others. I told myself it was enough. I told myself everyone has fantasies. I hated myself for wanting men when men had hurt me so badly. I told myself I was gay. I told myself this was all I could have so I couldn't get hurt. I told myself I was stone. For quite some time, I touched but wouldn't allow myself to be touched. I was stone and untouchable. I seethed. I was swollen with desire, with a desperate need to be touched, to feel a woman's skin against my skin, to find release through pleasure. I withheld even that from myself. I punished myself. I was stone. I could not bleed. Years later, I realized that I could bleed, and I could make others bleed. At the end of Adriana's visit, I returned home after taking her to the airport, leaving her with the promise we would see each other again soon. It was a promise I kept before I broke another promise and then broke her heart. Fiona had written me beautiful letters, telling me everything I always wanted to hear from her. I sat on my couch reading her words over and over, shaking because finally I had everything I wanted from her in the palm of my hand, and because even then I knew I was going to push her away. All I needed to do was pick up the phone and dial a number. All I needed to do was say yes. 69. For far too long, I did not know desire. I simply gave myself, gave my body to whoever offered me even the faintest of interest. This was all I deserved, I told myself. My body was nothing. My body was a thing to be used. My body was repulsive and therefore deserved to be treated as such. I did not deserve to be desired. I did not deserve to be loved. In relationships, I never allowed myself to make the first move because I knew I was repulsive. I did not allow myself to initiate sex. I did not dare want something so fine as affection or sexual pleasure. I knew I had to wait until it was offered each and every time. I had to be grateful for what was offered. I entered relationships with people who mostly tolerated me and occasionally offered me a trifle of affection. There was the woman who cheated on me and the woman who stabbed my favorite teddy bear with a steak knife and the woman who always seemed to need money and the woman who was too ashamed of me to take me to work parties. There were men too, but they were mostly unmemorable and frankly I expected them to hurt me. My body was nothing, so I let anything happen to my body. I had no idea what I enjoyed sexually because I was never asked and I knew my wants did not matter. I was supposed to be grateful. I had no right to seek satisfaction. Lovers were often rough with me as if that was the only way they could understand touching a body as fat as mine. I accepted this because I did not deserve kindness or a gentle touch. I was called terrible names, and I accepted this because I understood I was a terrible, repulsive thing. Sweet words were not for girls like me. I was treated so badly or indifferently for so long that I forgot what being treated well felt like. I stopped believing that such a thing existed. My heart received even less consideration than my body, so I tried to lock it away, but never quite succeeded. At least I am in a relationship, I always told myself. At least I am not so repulsive, so abject, that no one will spend time with me. At least I am not alone. 70. I am not good at romantic interactions that aren't furtive and kind of sleazy. I don't know how to ask someone on a date. I don't know how to gauge the potential interest of other human beings. I don't know how to trust people who do express interest in me. I am not the girl who gets the date in these circumstances, or that's what I cannot help but tell myself. I am always paralyzed by self-doubt and mistrust. Normally, I force myself to feel attraction to someone who expresses interest in me. It's mortifying to admit that, but it's also the truth. I doubt I am alone in this. I often think, maybe this is my last chance, my only chance. I better make it work. Having standards, or trying to have standards and sticking to them, has proven to be more difficult than I imagined. It is hard to say, I deserve something good. I deserve someone I actually like, and believe it because I am so used to believing I deserve whatever mediocrity comes my way. In our culture, we talk a lot about change and growing up, but man, we don't talk nearly enough about how difficult it is. It is difficult. For me, it is difficult to believe I matter and I deserve nice things and I deserve to be around nice people. I am also plagued by this idea that because I'm not a slender supermodel, I really have no business having standards. Who am I to judge someone whose opening salvo is, "How you doing?" That is a literal message I have received on a dating site. This self-esteem issue has shaped so much of my romantic life. My past is littered with mediocrity. I have had a couple of great relationships, too. Most of the time, though, I end up in these long, deeply unsatisfying relationships. Even when I'm in a good relationship, it is hard to stand up for myself. It is hard to express dissatisfaction or have the arguments I want to have because I feel like I'm already on thin ice by virtue of being fat. It is hard to ask for what I want and need and deserve, and so I don't. I act like everything is always fine, and it's not fair to me or anyone else. I am really trying to change this pattern and take a hard look at the choices I make and why. I don't want to be relieved when a relationship ends. I have things to offer. I am nice and funny, and I bake really well. I no longer want to believe I deserve nothing but mediocrity or downright shoddy treatment. I am trying to believe this with every fiber of my being. I often tell my students that fiction is about desire in one way or another. The older I get, the more I understand that life is generally the pursuit of desires. We want and want and oh, how we want. We hunger. 71. Sometimes I get so angry when I think about how my sexuality has been shaped. I get angry that I can draw a direct line between the first boy I loved, the boy who made me into the girl in the woods, and the sexual experiences I have had since. I get angry because I no longer want to feel his hands on my desires. I worry that I always will. My first relationship was my worst relationship. I was desperately young. My first relationship was with the boy who turned me into the girl in the woods. He was a good boy from a good family living in a good neighborhood, but he hurt me in the worst ways. People are rarely what they seem. The more I got to know him, the more I realized that he was always showing who he really was, and the people in his life either saw through him or closed their eyes. After that boy and his friends raped me, I was broken. I did not stop letting him do things to me, and that remains one of my greatest shames. I wish I knew why, or I do know why. I was dead, so nothing mattered. Since then, I've had many other relationships and none nearly that bad, but the damage was done. My course was set, and it's a shame that the measure is what is not so bad instead of what is thriving and good. I look at some of my worst relationships and I think, at least they didn't hit me. I work from a place of gratitude for the bare minimum. Since then, I've never been in a relationship where I've had to hide non-consensual bruises. I've never feared for my life. I've never been in a situation where I couldn't walk away. Does this make me a lucky girl? Given the stories I've heard from other women, yes, it does make me a lucky girl. This is not how we should measure luck. I have had good relationships, but it's hard to trust that because what I consider good doesn't always feel very good at all. Or I am thinking about testimony. I've heard from other women over the years, women sharing their truths, daring to use their voices to say, this is what happened to me, this is how I have been wronged. I've been thinking about how so much testimony is demanded of women, and still, there are those who doubt our stories. There are those who think we are all lucky girls because we are still, they narrowly assume, alive. I am weary of all our sad stories, not hearing them, but that we have these stories to tell, that there are so many. 72. In one of my past relationships, again in my 20s, things between us were not good, but also not that bad. It was the kind of relationship that reminds me that sometimes emotional abuse is even worse than physical abuse. I don't mind getting knocked around. I don't say that cavalierly. There are simply some things to which I am numb. This person, though, wanted to break me down, which became interesting because I did not realize I could still be broken down further. Who knew? They did, I guess. They smelled it on me. There was nothing dramatic or violent between us. It was simply that I faced a barrage of constant criticism. Nothing I ever did was good enough. I was in my 20s and desperately insecure, so I thought this was what all relationships were like. I thought this was what I deserved because I was so worthless. I couldn't spend time with this person's colleagues without a rigorous critique of everything wrong with me that I needed to try and improve. Most of the time, as you might imagine, we were not together in public because I was just not good enough. I never looked nice enough. I talked too loud. I breathed too loud. I slept too loud. I was too warm while I slept. I moved too much while I slept. I basically stopped sleeping. I just hugged as small a sliver of the edge of the bed as I could and stayed awake so my sleeping wouldn't be such a nuisance. I was always tired. I didn't wash dishes correctly. There is a right way and a wrong way to wash dishes. I know that now. Don't get water on the floor. Drain the dish rack. Be careful how you organize the dishes in the dish rack. One of my favorite things to do now is to wash dishes any old way. I spill water on the floor and I smile because these are my fucking floors and these are my dishes and no one cares if there is water on the floor. I didn't eat food correctly. I ate too fast. I chewed too loudly. I chewed ice too often. I didn't put things away correctly. I didn't arrange my shoes by the front door the right way. I swung my arms while walking. I would be told these things and then have to try and remember all the things I shouldn't do so I wouldn't be so upsetting by just existing. We would be walking and I would remember, okay, hold your arms at your side. Do not swing your arms. I would spend all my time just reminding myself, don't swing your arms. And then I might get distracted and forget and accidentally let my arm move an inch or two and I would hear this exasperated sigh. So I would redouble my efforts to make myself less upsetting to this person I loved. Don't swing your arms, Roxanne. Sometimes I catch myself trying not to swing my arms even now, and I get so angry. I get so fucking angry, and I want to swing my arms like a windmill. These are my arms. This is how I walk. One day, I went to a department store and got my makeup done. I thought I looked pretty. I wanted to look pretty for this person. I bought a bunch of makeup so I could be a better girl. I went to their house to surprise them, and they looked me up and down and told me what else I could do to be more tolerable, more presentable to them. I stood there on the front porch, wanting my body to collapse in on itself. I had been so excited, so happy I had made myself pretty, and it wasn't good enough. I certainly didn't try that again. I went home with all my expensive makeup and my pretty face, and then I cried that makeup off. The makeup is still in a yellow bag in my closet. Sometimes I take it out and look at it, but I don't dare use it. When I get my makeup done for television appearances while I am promoting a book or when I am asked to comment on pop culture or the political climate, I feel like I'm wearing a mask I have no right to wear. The makeup feels far thicker than it really is. I feel like people are staring at me, laughing at me for daring to think I could do anything to make myself more presentable. And I remember how I felt the one time I tried to look pretty for someone, how it wasn't enough. The first chance I get, I scrub the makeup off. I choose to live in my own skin. I was never going to be good enough, but I tried so hard. I tried to make myself better. I tried to make myself acceptable to someone who would never find me acceptable, but kept me around for reasons I cannot begin to make sense of. I stayed because they confirmed every terrible thing I already knew about myself. I stayed because I thought no one else would possibly tolerate someone as worthless as me. I stayed through infidelity and disrespect. I stayed until they no longer wanted me around. I would like to think at some point I would have left, but we always want to think the best of ourselves, don't we? But I am a lucky girl. I think most of my sad stories are behind me. There are things I will no longer tolerate. Being alone sucks, but I would rather be alone than be with someone who makes me feel that terrible. I am realizing I am not worthless. Knowing that feels good. My sad stories will always be there. I am going to keep telling them, even though I hate having the stories to tell. These sad stories will always weigh on me, though that burden lessens the more I realize who I am and what I am worth. 73. The thing is, though, loneliness, like losing control of my body, is a matter of accretion. 12 years of living in very rural places, a lifetime of shyness and social ineptitude and isolation, these things make the loneliness build and build, and it cloaks me sometimes. It is a constant, unwelcome companion. For so long, I closed myself off from everything and everyone. Terrible things happened, and I had to shut down to survive. I was cold, I've been told. I often write stories about women who are perceived as cold and resent that perception. I write these women because I know what it's like to have so much warmth roiling beneath the skin's surface, ready to be found. I am not cold. I wasn't ever cold. My warmth was hidden far away from anything that could bring hurt because I knew I didn't have the inner scaffolding to endure any more hurt in those protected places. My warmth was hidden until I found the right people with whom to share it. People I could trust, friends from graduate school, friends I met through the writing community when I was first starting out, the people who have always been willing to see and take me exactly as I am. I am not promiscuous with my warmth, but when I share it, my warmth can be as hot as the sun. 74. Part of the reason relationships and friendships can be so difficult for me is because there is a part of me that thinks I have to get things just right. I have to say the right things and do the right things or I won't be liked or loved anymore. It's stressful, so then I engage in an elaborate attempt at being the best friend or girlfriend and get further and further away from who I really am, someone with a good heart, but also someone who may not always get things right. I find myself apologizing for things I shouldn't be apologizing for things I am not at all sorry for. I find myself apologizing for who I am. And even when I am with good, kind, loving people, I don't trust that goodness, kindness, or love. I worry that sooner or later they will make my losing weight a condition of their continued affection. That fear makes me try harder to get things right, as if I am hedging my bets. All of this makes me very hard on myself, very driven. I just keep working and working and working and trying to be right, and I lose sight of who I am or what I want, which leaves me in a less than ideal place. It leaves me nowhere. With age comes self-awareness, or something that looks like self-awareness, and so I try to be on the lookout for patterns of behavior, choices I'm making where I'm trying too hard, giving too much, reaching too intently for being right, where right is what someone else wants me to be. It's scary, though, trying to be yourself and hoping yourself is enough. It's scary believing that you, as you are, could ever be enough. There is an anxiety in being yourself, though. There is the haunting question of what if, always lingering. What if who I am will never be enough? What if I will never be right enough for someone?